You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges. And follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Hello and welcome. I must apologise in advance. Our MEP host, Mr. Philip De Backa, is likely to be a little bit late. So if you see someone coming in a rush, coming to sit down, it is our host, MEP. As often happens in the Parliament, political events elsewhere often take up time. So just to let you know, his apologies, but he will come to join us. So welcome to the Friends of Europe first in a series of roundtables looking at disruptive innovation in healthcare. My name is Tamsin Rose, and I am a non-resident fellow for the Friends of Europe, and it will be my pleasure to facilitate today and the next two roundtables. So, and just I'll give you a minute just to check that you are in the right room. There are several events happening in the Parliament at any one time, so I like to give people a polite 30 seconds to decide that this is the conversation they want to be in.
Tamsin, I can tell you, I was in the wrong one at Friends of Europe half an hour ago, and it looked very good, and the lunch was terrific.
Excellent. Thank you. So you downgraded in terms of lunch, but I promise you'll upgrade in terms of quality of conversation. Okay. So why are we here? The European Union, and particularly the European Commission, has a relatively limited role in regulation in health. The treaty says so. But over the years, there's been a succession of court cases, there's been a directive on cross-border care, so the EU role has grown. But in this area of technology and innovation, the EU has a much greater role, both as a convener of stakeholders, a catalyst for funding and for change. But in this particular session, we're going to be looking at the regulatory framework and the extent to which it acts either as a brake on innovation or as a facilitator. And we're going to be asking questions, is our current method, regulatory method, appropriate and fit for purpose? Is it too slow? Does it understand the issues? Does it hold in place the necessary patient safeguards and reliability that we need in healthcare? Because healthcare is different. We all acknowledge that. So these are some of the questions that I'd like us to think about and talk about in our time together. We have a very distinguished panel who will kick off our conversations by giving a five-minute opening statement, and then we'll open up for exchanges with the room. So let me first invite Sabine Koch from the Karolinska Institute. Now, we were speaking just in the break, and you were telling me some of the different issues that you deal with and how you're actually also training people from all around the world in health informatics at the cutting edge of innovation. So from your point of view, how do we rebalance the regulatory framework so it matches both the pace of innovation and what people really want from regulation? If I invite you and all speakers to press the button for your microphone. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, as we all know, the regulatory framework often feels quite slow, and people think it's always lagging behind, especially in healthcare. It has often, in my mind, also been used as an excuse for not pushing things, for not sharing data in the past. If you think about disruptive innovations or where there could come a revolution in healthcare, I think in the basis healthcare as such is more an evolution than a revolution. If I see a revolution, then it comes from the patient's side and the consumer side, where we see a lot in the quantified self movement, for example, today, where people track their health or even self-manage their health. And these people have to do a lot of decisions about, they should be given the power to make decisions on to whom share their data with, in my opinion. But they have also to be informed, and in practical implementation of that, we don't really know right now, okay, what can they decide? Do they just accept to share with everybody? Open up with so-called open health platforms where we can reuse interoperable data and allow patients to share them with either providers or third-party providers' apps for example. So there will, I guess we will see a lot of new stakeholders in this area developing things. But for me, the main issue is that we can protect this data as well, so that it's really data quality is an issue still today, and also can we really de-identify data? Do we have algorithms that are good enough for that? We see that today hospitals are intruded by external people where, for example, they are threatened to have the health data exchange, or the medical technical equipment is managed at a distance from somebody else when it's hacked. If we think that we in the future have more and more autonomous systems, they could, of course, be intruded from the outside, and these are things that we somehow need to protect. Not everything can be done by regulation, I guess, but... for example, research on big data is something that we should regulate. I think I will stop with this for now.
Thank you. You've identified for us some really interesting questions that we'll explore in more detail, particularly where is the role and space for regulation in some of these big issues. You've identified the quality of the data. Can we really anonymize it? Security threats, particularly concerns of hacking and ransoming. You know, and how do we use the research on big data, and where does the data go and get used? So thank you for that. And that will gives me an opportunity to pass the floor to our MEP host. Welcome, Mr. Tabaka. We're exploring here what's the role of regulation, bearing in mind both the limited legal mandate and the time frame for regulation. It's not something that moves fast. It's a slow dance rather than a fast dance. So how does the regulatory environment move at a speed that it still maintains some of these issues of quality and security, but creates some freedom for innovation?
Very good question. My apologies, first of all, for being late. I was caught up on another event. I had to speak there on energy policy, but that's another matter. Although I think for hospitals, for example, and energy supply and security of that is also not unimportant. I think that what we see today in Europe is indeed that at European level, at least, we have limited mandate to go into healthcare systems or to go into healthcare regulation. Although, I think that with a lot of the innovations that we see going on today, we do have a role to play. If you see, for example, and look at, for example, everything that has to do with e-health, m-health, security of aspects of that, I think that on digital market aspects, I think we can really put out the infrastructure and the groundwork for these new applications to flourish. I think that's a role that the European Union can play. What I also see more and more is that member states are looking at the European Union also for guidance on how to reform their systems, how to make them more flexible, how to make them more welcoming for innovation, how to make sure also that best practices are being shared between member states. So it doesn't always have to be hardcore regulation. And I think this is where really the shift, for me at least, should take place, that on the one hand, this kind of mentality change where we on the continent often think that as long as something is not regulated, it is forbidden, while you see in other continents that market experimentation is much more allowed and that users in the end will determine whether something functions for them, yes or no. And so also requiring security, safety, transparency, who has access to data and things like that. So I think on that front we see hopefully also in the near future mentality change where we don't want to go into hardcore regulation but also allow to market that there are experiments between patients, between payers, between health institutions to make sure that things are moving forward. On the other hand, of course, there is also the need for, let's say, framework regulation. When you talk, for example, about patient data, I think then, for example, privacy issues come to the fore. And, of course, there, I think the European Union does have a role to play to make sure that every European citizen has the same rights built into the system, wherever they live, whatever they do, to make sure that they feel protected and they can be secure, that at least some basic aspects of certain fundamental rights are being covered at the European level. So what I hope to see over the next couple of years is exactly those three things. The fact that we lay out the groundwork to do the infrastructure and the basis to help these new applications to flourish. And this is also the fact that we help, we are investing in research, we're investing in the reindustrialization of Europe. All these kind of elements play into that. Secondly, of course, that we make sure that indeed, let's say, the hardcore fundamental rights are protected at European level and are also thought out in such a way that it doesn't hamper the use and the new applications of these data. I mean, there's always a balance there. For example, a very concrete discussion I had recently with a couple of national member states was the fact that their payers and their mutualité in some countries, they hold a lot of data, which is very interesting if it could be used by certain NGOs or private partners to build new insights into disease development, adherence to therapies, things like that. But this data is locked up. It's often still in paper format, and if it's already available in a digital format, it's locked up within the institution. So we should also try at European level to devise new systems to allow to unlock these data, because in the end it will serve also patients and citizens in Europe. And thirdly, I think that we have to continue thinking and allowing market experimentation and not directly jump into hardcore regulation, because I think in the end you also see that patients, citizens are much more empowered and much more vocal today on what they expect as a service or as a product than they used to be in the past, maybe. Okay.
Thank you. So you've given me a very nice bridge to pass the floor to our next speaker, Peter Selgavis from the European Commission, because you mentioned the digital market and the digital single market. That is, of course, one of the top 10 political priorities of Mr. Juncker for this mandate. So we need to find where we, from health, fit within that big picture of a priority for digital market. Peters, I'm sure you'll tell us.
Thank you very much. And perhaps I'll start by quoting Professor Joseph Schumpeter, the Austrian and later American economist, who was saying that creative destruction is the essence of capitalism. What people sometimes forget, that he was writing it in a book, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, and deriving the term from Karl Marx, that he subtitled, Will Capitalism Survive? Because creative destruction, while allowing innovation, change, also causes turmoil in the society. And we live in democratic societies. People do need to be protected. This is not by stopping the creative destruction. This way we stop the economy from working. But it is by making sure that the results do fit our societal goals. So then I also will quote now Catholic social teaching and subsidiaris, which is subsidiarity. And it is completely correct, as the previous speakers were saying, that running the health systems is up to the member states. Personally believe in this, and I think it's right. They are closer to the needs. But on the other hand, a lot of the tools, especially the digital tools, can help them get solutions at a lower price, to have more efficiency, to have better access, to provide jobs, to have new enterprises in the member states, which then, of course, generate income to be able to pay for the social systems. And this is where the digital single market comes in. With the digital single market, if there's an app, if there's an other digital solution, if you have also consulting services, let's not forget about procedural innovation, new ways to do things. Ideally, it moves completely across the borders and rapidly and is not stopped by geo-blocking where you see this service is not available in your country. And this is where a little bit we have the mix between the internal market and the health. People were mentioning the patients' rights in cross-border healthcare. Originally, this directive, though the health article was added later, was based on the free movement of people. It was an internal market proposal. And this is an example of the way that we can reach goals, people having better care as they're moving through the union, also making sure that the economy works more efficiently. And then I'll finish with just a few examples of the way that with the digital single market approach, we are trying to support innovation in health and at the same time to try to make sure that citizens are protected. We have a code of conduct being developed on mHealth apps by the industry. The Commission is facilitating this. They'll be submitting it to the Article 29 Working Party, hopefully in the very near future. I was finishing a conference call when I came here today. So making sure that the privacy and the security of the mHealth apps is guaranteed. Another action that we have is on guidelines on linking apps to the electronic health records. The decision whether to have the data going into the EHR is up to, often not even the member state, it goes down to even the hospital level or the city level. But guidelines can help. Which of these apps, which will be hopefully all freely available throughout the EU, is suitable for going into the healthcare system and with data, and then the decision is taken. And then finally, when there is something that can cause harm, that can really go wrong, and I'm announcing a public consultation that we'll have very soon, probably in April, in conjunction with the publication of the Digitalizing European Industry Communication, which is kind of a twin brother or sister of Digital Single Market, it's going to be apps and other non-embedded software. And this is something we discovered in the mHealth Green Paper public consultation, that the consumer product safety directive and upcoming regulation don't cover the software, the apps that are not already with a device. So, again, we're not jumping in to regulate. This will be a political decision taking later. But we found a legal issue, which we've identified, and we're going to be asking the public, is this a danger? Obviously, in the mHealth area is one area where we can see things going wrong. Another area is where the app is operating something in the smart home. It can also be with transport if it hasn't been agreed upon by the transport manufacturer, the car manufacturer, but the citizen has downloaded it. 3D printers is another area. Blockchain and distributed ledger technologies are another area. So here's another way that we are looking to make sure that these are great tools, but if they cause harm, the person who developed the faulty software program, the faulty programming, is the one who will pay eventually, and if the thing is faulty, that it can be taken off the market. And with that, I'd be very glad as well to hear what the other colleagues are thinking, and of course what all the listeners will have to have as inputs.
Thank you. And now I'll give the floor to our final panelist, Christina Beskos, who comes from Philips Healthcare and also is the coordinator of the EIP activities, the European Innovation Partnership on Healthy and Active Aging. We've just heard there from the Commission that they don't jump into regulation, but when they see a gap, they ask if it's a problem and then see if they will fill it. From your point of view, both as a company that innovates but also interacts here with the stakeholders and the regulators, what would be your advice on how the EU could regulate appropriately?
Thank you. It fits very much to what I was having in mind in to present here. I mean, first, I think just when we mention about disrupting innovation in healthcare, we shouldn't think anymore about gadgets and small devices, but really about the disruption will come from the transformation process, so it's from the new service model, from the new concepts and service delivery. And in that sense, it's a new way of making innovation that needs the collaboration of many stakeholders. And for me, it's really this regulatory framework that has to facilitate this kind of new collaborations. And I'm going to be concrete in 5 points where I see from the industry part elements that could improve, and maybe we can have a discussion about that. We have mentioned about data privacy and data protection regulation. I think the harmonization of those regulations will facilitate a lot that you make some sense of the larger infrastructures. So we it's very difficult now to really make sense of very small or localized infrastructures in order to cover a country or even a region or a hospital specific in implementation. The second point I would like to address is the guidance related to medical devices, and I think you mentioned related to apps specifically, but we need some guidelines or some guidance in what is a medical device and what not. And when you have a complete solutions that cover many different parts, who takes responsibility of that whole solution? And what is the responsibility of the individual manufacturers if it's used in a different intended use than originally provided? No? The third one is related to the availability of this health data for research, and I think we really have a big constraint in Europe, and I think we are getting into a situation that most of the decision support systems are now based on data from other geographies where they have a different ethnicity or they have different lifestyles, and we may risk, I mean, to have automatic systems that are not really based on the European populations. The fourth point is related to the interoperability standards. So, and I'm not talking here about the policy level only of reaching consensus and awareness. I think it's really on the practical use, because standards are, and I'm specifically talking about the home area, we need support in the accreditation process. So now the standards are published, but we have too little offer from the industry side in order to be really sustained in public tenders and to have enough coverage of the needs of the hospitals or providers. And the last one, as I say, is in terms of investment. So please, let's stop investing in small, localized solution and try to really to make the impact, because what will make the disruption is really this large, the scalability element. And we need to align all the different funding schemes, whether European or national or local or private-public partnerships, in order to make this impact happen.
Thank you. That's some very interesting ideas that have been put forward by our panelists. And let me just try and see if I can pick up some of the elements from the vision. Don't do small, do big, because that's where the change will come from. And we've also heard a slightly different viewpoint from Sabine, who said, well, actually the revolution rather than evolution is coming from individual consumers who are going out and buying devices, apps, they're quantifying, measuring themselves. So we've got two different views. Do they meet? You're saying, you know, the money needs to go in the big scale infrastructure. And you're saying that the push for change will come from the individual user rather than necessarily the system. Would you like to comment?
I don't think it's conflicting, actually.
Put your mic on.
It's my point. Infrastructure and then
I don't think it's conflicting. It's, as you say, the push comes from the individual, but the infrastructure has to be done or guided in a larger view. And if I may say some two points about what she said, was about the public tenders, because innovation procurement is an area where we are not really good. I think I see it in our side and at the hospital, they are really struggling how to do it. But the public procurement is a problem to get innovation into the system. And the third point would be, for me, impact measurement. If we really want to achieve impact, we also need to know what is it we want to measure and how do we do that, because that's something which we often forget about. We're just doing things and running ahead, but you're not really following up.
Let me turn this back to the MEP Debaka. This issue about public procurement, that we're actually having difficulty doing public procurement to get innovation in. This is an area where there is quite significant EU regulation. To what extent do you think that the regulation is supportive? Does it need to be changed or updated? Or do you think it's already sufficient to allow people with a bit of creativity to use it to get innovation into their services?
It's a heavy regulation, of course. I mean, everybody who has gone through a European tendering process knows the burden that it brings. On the other hand, the regulation is in place basically to provide a level playing field and transparency in the choice of providers. It doesn't, a little bit yes, but it doesn't explicitly say what are the main criteria. So it depends also on how you structure your tender in such a way that it's possible to allow innovation to come in. But of course, if, and this is the point that I would like to make, if you are only interested in a very small subset of your whole organization or subset when you do the tender, and when you're only interested in getting and have the incentive to only go for the lowest price, then it's very difficult to have a more long-term view and a much more broader view on what kind of provider in the end will fit your organization maybe better, will provide much more sustainable solutions for the long run and things like that. So I think it's a combination of both, but I don't really see how you can put that into regulation as such. I think that what we need to do is not only with public procurement, but also in other discussion that we're having between the bottom-up and the top-down, I think it's have a much more holistic view on things. I think we often focus on a very small subset and try to fix a small problem, but forget how it fits into the larger process of things. And so when you look, for example, at healthcare as a whole, there's a lot of efficiency gains to be made if you would change systems, not just subsets of systems or tiny parts of how operations are being run, but systems as a whole to start a rethink. And this requires the input from consumers, patients, and the bottom-up story, but it also requires an overview of where you want to go and how you want to put things in a certain organization. So my point there always is that incentives matter. If, for example, certain member states are looking to have closer collaborations between hospitals, for example, to share not only information but also infrastructure, if you know that the doctors are being paid per use of a certain machine in a certain hospital, yeah, then it will be very difficult to convince them that collaboration is a good thing, because in the end of the day, it's their paycheck who's going to be affected. And for them, that's, of course, a very genuine and okay reason, and I'm not saying here to have to go into a socialistic system, but in the end, efficiency gains can be made when also you get a buy-in from the different stakeholders and you rethink really a system and an organization. I think then by providing the right incentives from policymakers, but also local decision-makers, hospital directions and everything else, then I think you will see change happening. But today there are a lot of incentives in the system which are hampering innovation and are not allowing people to cooperate better.
If those are the things that you see, where would you see the leadership to change them? I mean, we have political momentum behind the idea of the digital single market.
Yep.
Is that where the leadership will or should come from, or would it come through subsidiarity? Should it come further down? Because you've identified, you know, the incentives matter, agreed. There are efficiency gains, you need stakeholder buy-in, but it's quite strongly linked to the way member states have structured their own health systems. So what's the European role?
I think the European role is plenty. I mean, again, I think we have a huge role to play in setting the framework right of allowing information flows, the infrastructure investment to be done in a way that users can start using the infrastructure in a very innovative way that we as policymakers have never thought of. That's the first thing. The second thing, of course, is that what you see today is that member states understand that they sometimes have to also look across borders. And this, I think the European Union on one hand can help by sharing best practices and setting up expert networks, which is being done. But then, of course, member states also have to implement some of these recommendations, and often that is where it's lacking. Secondly, I see a lot of creativity today already. Give you one example that I know quite well, is the fact that the Benelux countries are starting to work together on how to tackle the issue of rare diseases and market access and patient access to new drugs. And so this is one of the steps where it's clear that there's leadership from the health ministries in those three countries sitting together, trying to come up with a solution, and hopefully this will develop into a best practice and then can be shared among other member states. So I think you see at all these different levels that there is leadership, there is possibility to come up with new ways of thinking and new ways of doing things. But again, when you look in practice how, for example, the Benelux Corporation is working, indeed you sometimes hit both European but mainly national breaks on cooperation, because there is cultural difference, okay, fine, but also regulatory issues which have to be solved. And I think this process we should help at the European level to speed up this kind of process and help these countries to go faster.
Thank you. I'm delighted that we have several other MEPs here in the audience, so I'm going to invite them to express some of their views. We have Mr. Poch, Mr. Pitili, and Mrs. Semilova. Shall we start down here?
Yeah, thank you. I'm afraid that for me there is more questions than answers. So first, when I'm hearing all this, I sometimes don't know if we didn't forget true sense of healthcare. And it is a question, what is the true sense of the healthcare? Is it making money or is it caring for people? Sometimes I don't know when I am listening to stakeholders and innovators and pharmacological companies and everybody involved. I sometimes don't know if the true sense of healthcare is caring for health or it is making money. So this is the first question of mine. Second, I've seen a lot of paper from the United States and from other countries and about the most important question of these times, and we should assess what brings more benefit to the citizens, if it is, say, innovation at all costs or a broad use of existing technologies and medicals in favor of as much people as possible. We are speaking about innovative medicines in cancer treatment, oncology, and anywhere, and we have people who are not able to get paracetamol in Europe. That's true. That's reality. And this is a second question of mine. Should we care more about innovations, or should we care more about spreading what is available to as much people as possible? On e-health and other issues, yeah, of course, a final destination of this process probably is something like personalized healthcare. I think the e-health is the only tool. And we should, think about the question, if it is an only tool, if there is not one more tool, which is more humanization of healthcare. Because we had personalized healthcare once. Family doctors, it was a personalized healthcare. So we should think, if we need all these information technology, if people need it, or if we need more humanity in healthcare. Just let's think, nothing more, nothing less. And on regulations, I've seen in the program here a barriers to the introduction of new technologies need to be assessed and where necessary removed. Shouldn't we say where safe removed? We are saying here openly where necessary removed. Shouldn't we remove those barriers when it is safe? I don't think that EU has too much regulatory issues in healthcare because it's mostly agenda of member states. So, just the questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Peterley, would you like to come in?
Thank you very much. First of all, I would like to say that I agree with Commissioner Ansip, who recently said that digital applications potential may or could transform quality and efficiency of healthcare. And I also think there is unused potential in that regard. While dealing with this aspect of the story, which cannot be described as healthcare in narrow sense of the word. So here we have potential to regulate. We don't have in health, as far as health is concerned, in usual terms, where we hear so many times or heard so many times about the competencies. No? I think that our problem is that development is so fast, so quick, that many people, even professionals, have problems to understand what is going on and which challenges are related to the innovation which is done, I would say, several times a day by new applications. No? And there is quite a strong development we follow with, I would say, we don't follow in a proper way, let's say so. Regulatory process is quite long one, let's say so, is time consuming and so on. And you know that I said several times already that also in health, in narrow sense of word, where new technologies or new approaches, new therapies are developed, those medical doctors or advanced centers, efficient centers, have problems because we are not able to follow them when they ask a better regulatory framework. And I just would like to add something what was mentioned yesterday at the workshop of Working Group Health, which is, I would say, working structure of the environmental committee, we spoke about refugees. You know, when Slovenia had to deal with the first 10,000 of refugees, we realized that particular our refugees from North African countries were sick, or I will put that in a very, very simple language. They came with some animals which are not that usual in my country, let's say so. And we didn't have drugs for that, no? But then those refugees left for Austria. But we didn't keep them with data. They just went there as they were, with all their problems. And from Austria to Germany, they travel with their illnesses, with their infections, with their problems, but they don't travel with data about that, their status. And now, through this example, we can come back to your questions which were revealed at the beginning: interoperability, compatibility, comparability, and so on. No? So this is one more fact which will not disappear tomorrow, regardless what will be agreed in Germany, Austria, Slovenia, Croatia, and so on, no? Or in Visegrad countries. We will face for a long time another cross-border healthcare issue. And I think that what I like in this approach of Friends of Europe, I'm part of it, that I think I see this as an endeavor, as an effort to address Europe, I would say, cross-border healthcare issues with due attention. And refugees are just one more element of that story, no? I don't like to discuss now Brexit and other possible exits, but whatever will be outcome or whatever those who think we need less Europe will do, we will see that in this particular area, health, we definitely need more cooperation, whether we say this ever closer union or more Europe or whatever, whichever slogan will be used, I don't care. But we definitely need to coordinate better our efforts to agree on standards, not only as far as digital single market is concerned, and so on. So I would be pleased if this, our common or joint efforts would lead to more understanding what is going on, which challenges are we facing, and what should be undertaken. And only one more fact, and then I will finish, which was mentioned yesterday. Tuberculosis is a growing challenge. HIV in some population categories is going down. But in eastern part of Europe, especially in special categories, I would say, is growing. No? 44% in gay population. You know, we have to think about that. Hepatitis C growing. No? So we have many indicators where we only see upwards developments. No? And we have to do more than just to explain to citizens that health is national member states' competence. Thank you.
Thank you. Mrs. Senelova.
Yes, thank you very much, and I apologize for being late, so I missed some important interventions from the beginning, but my colleagues already put on the table very important questions, and I don't have much to add to this. I personally care or have a little concern, maybe not a little concern, but a big concern, that the new technologies will not create that phenomenon, what we call a digital divide, but also with the concern healthcare. I see these technologies, yes, if they make healthcare more accessible. And, we shouldn't have new technologies, but we also should have people who are able to use it. And I think that's in our countries we are struggling with the personnel in healthcare and such, and that brings me back to the question what Pavel was asking. That should bring us back also to financing of the public services. So we shouldn't end up with centers of excellence, but on the other hand, to struggle to provide even the basic care. So that's only my remark. Thanks.
Thank you. And I'm delighted to welcome another MEP who I didn't have a chance to announce earlier. José Fournier is here. Would you like to come in on this conversation?
Yes, thank you. Also, my apologies for being so late, and in a few minutes I have to go. But there are some issues that the little that I have heard here. Let me tell you of an example of some barriers. It's also here in the Parliament. We are here, parliamentarians here, and we bring barriers ourselves between our groups, and that's honestly it's unfortunately. I can give you an example. We have the Zika problem at the moment, and there is this oral question that all the groups are now involved, and obviously just to give you an example, that barriers can also be created here. And we are trying to pass this question on the virus Zika and also the problem of the microcephaly. And it's impossible for us to, we do not want to connect one issue with another, but we want to have scientific evidence that the liver site has got nothing to do with the virus itself. But there are no proven scientific data. And what I'm saying is that we have proposed this to be included in our oral question, and the rest of the groups do not want that because of the industry. This is one of the barriers. But mainly the barriers are we find these barriers in implementing healthcare initiatives within the member states. And I can give you so many examples from my country, Portugal, so many with Spain. Cross-border health care, for instance. And I can give you another example. You know that there is this advanced mobile location, talking about the internet and the mobile applications that can be used to save lives. I have tried to convince the authorities in my country to implement the advanced mobile location. I think some of you must know, it's been implemented in some European countries, namely the UK, and it has been proven, in fact, that the possibility of locating someone that has a medical emergency, it's about five meters away from the location. And it can save lives, because in my country, the location through mobile with other services can position a person about 1.5 kilometers away, which is, in an emergency, you must understand that this is a crucial issue. I have asked the mobile telecommunication operators, the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Internal Affairs, and all the actors in this field, and I only got, and that was quite some time ago, I only got a reply from one, and from one operator, that they are interested, but all the other actors must come together. So it's not easy for us here to as co-legislators to advance some measures as well. Well, as I told you, between the groups is difficult, but when we passed and when we manage to get this through, then the implementation at member states, it's not easy. And, well, basically this is what I wanted to say. There's a lot to be done, and but we have to start here, and we have to, between colleagues, to be more proactive, perhaps, and then perhaps think of other actions. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that first exchange of views, and we do appreciate MEPs taking time to be with us. I know that many of you have several demands on you during the same time period, so thank you for spending time with us. At this point, I'd like to just open this up to the floor and hear comments, suggestions from other people. If I can come back to something that Peter, as he said, it's about creative destruction, and that this is where the innovative disruption will come from, but we've heard pleas to be aware of inequalities and make sure that we don't increase the digital divide. We heard a powerful message from Mr. Potch that healthcare has to have about retain its element of humanity, and that it's all very well talking about new, sharp, shiny, expensive things when some people still don't have access to the most basic materials that already exist in healthcare. Yes, so if we're relying on technology to be the vehicle of moving us in the big leap forward, be aware there are some people who don't have access to that now. We also heard a plea, don't invest in the small stuff, go for the big picture, keep the safety elements, but we still need to sort of need to get to grips with a little bit of, you know, how will this innovation and disruption happen? Healthcare is fragmented. It's challenging, it's slow, it has lots of interests involved. It's unclear in some countries. I was talking to Sabine just before we began that even in some countries we have, the regulation doesn't say that patients own their own data, which was a surprise to me. I thought that was a basic acquis that was accepted for everywhere across Europe. Apparently not. So there's lots of areas that we could think about, but where do we start? How do we get this disruption started? So if you could signal for me that you would like to come in, and when you speak, if you could introduce your name and your organisation. Peter, questions over to you.
Sorry, thanks. Peter O'Donnell, journalist here in Brussels. I want to just throw in at this point a reflection about this wonderful idea of mastering, manipulating, directing all this creative disruption. But as a devil's advocate, can I just throw in the thought that nearly all the changes in healthcare in Europe that I'm aware of over the last 50 years have been reactive, not proactive. I don't really need to run through the list, but I mean, thalidomide led to marketing authorizations, mediator led to the pharmacovigilance tightening, it was H1N1 that led to procurement changes. I could go on and on and on, but I mean, there's a list of a dozen things that I won't bore you with. To what extent, I'm not trying to rain on the parade at all, but to what extent do people here feel that Europe actually has the capacity for moving forward? What examples have we got that already demonstrate that there is that capacity for creative, proactive work rather than simply a reactive response to crises which drive then the need for action?
I'll take a few more inputs and then I'll pass it back to the panel. So, yes. Tapani, sorry, I've forgotten your name from, yes, Doc Max. Max, and over here, yes, Tapani.
Good afternoon, Tapani Piha from DG Health and Food Safety. Actually, I would like to jump on what Peter was saying, because Peter is actually coming from a sector which is undergoing a massive creative destruction, the journalism, the publishing houses. What is the difference between the publishing houses, because you all know that the papers are on the way out, and at the same time, in this new digital revolution has given voice to anybody to publish their articles and the opinions without any control, and without any education or any ethic, which the journalists used to have, and still have, journalists still have. But the difference with the healthcare is that healthcare is very, very regulated profession. Everything that's happening in hospitals, in professions, they are regulated. Therefore, that kind of revolution which has happening in the journalism is not possible in health. And the question is that also means that, for example, in the healthcare, then the powerful professional groups, they can sort of control the pace of disruptive change in health. And the question then for the policymakers is to see that how much this is good, how much that is not good, and we should actually address it. That's one idea. The other idea is that because there was a lot of discussion about disruptive change being just technological. Digi Sante has an expert panel on innovative ways in investing in health, which brings together 12 reputable scientists, and they actually have just published an opinion called Disruptive Innovation in Healthcare. And they published a preliminary opinion, and the final opinion is expected in about 6 weeks' time. But you can already see the preliminary opinion on the website. But they have 8 case studies. And out of the 8 case studies, 4 are based on technologies. 4 others are based on social change. For example, one of the case studies is the Swedish rehabilitation guarantee. And another one is the patient-centered care. So they are giving examples of that kind of disruptive changes which are not based on technology, but on a change of the social systems.
Max Müller from Doc Morris. Picking up on what Peter said, I would say that one of the biggest driver of innovations in Europe are actually the courts, whether it's the European Court of Justice or domestic courts, because, and I beg to differ, even in a regulated business like healthcare, innovation in the way that it's happening in media is possible. We can see that all over the world. Now, the problem is, do we need less regulation? No, I don't think so. But obviously, the speed of innovation is so increasing that we cannot compare our measures with the time of the steam machine of Mr. Watt. If we look at the digital single market agenda, we're discussing in 2016 ideas based on studies from 2010 that will be passed into law hopefully in 2017, invoke in member states in 2020, with the technical standard of, I don't know, 7 years ago. So it's not the problem that we do not have the right regulation. It's obviously the measures how to impose and implement them. And nowadays, what's happening is that smaller ideas, smaller companies try to move forward. And actually, it has become part of a business model, obviously, for the law firms to say, it is better to try to get sued in order to create room for innovation than to actually wait and talk through a regulatory process. Whether this is the right consequence, I don't know, but this is just a pure fact. And it's not only for healthcare true. I think there are a lot of things like data security, etc., in which the courts have made faster decisions than they happen actually in public debate.
Thank you very much. I'm John Higgins from Digital Europe, the Tech Industry Association, but I've also for the last 18 months or so been chairing a piece of work for DG Grow, looking at the application of digital in a number of different sectors, in fact across the economy. And one of the areas that we've had a bit of a deep dive on is healthcare and pharmaceutical. And in the course of that, I think two things emerged in the healthcare sector as being particular challenges, and they're linked challenges, and I think to some extent have already been mentioned. One is the inability in Europe to make full use of data for research purposes, and largely constrained by either real or fears of transgressing our data protection rules. And the other linked to it is inconsistency in the use of electronic care records across Europe based on at least European, if not ideally global, standards. And The two challenges and the opportunities, in a sense, that we're missing were brought home to me in one particular workshop where we had the opportunity to talk to the Chief Medical Information Officer, if you can imagine such a title, Chief Medical Information Officer for Kaiser Permanente. And you might know that Kaiser is an American organization. It's actually a mutual. It's about a $50 billion turnover organization that employs 200,000 people. It's about a fifth or a sixth of the size of the UK NHS. But the Chief Medical Information Officer was explaining that he'd been absolutely rigorous in imposing a consistent electronic patient record throughout Kaiser Permanente. And as a result of that, and the ability to analyze data on a massive scale, they were able to roll out new advice to their frontline doctors within 24 hours of being able to analyze the data. And he compared the ability to learn things like, don't use this treatment and that treatment at the same time, fairly simple things. But the data they were able to analyze was of sufficient size that they could roll out new treatments more quickly. And I have to say that the medical researchers in the group that we were talking to at the time, the European medical researchers, were almost pulling their hair out at their own inability, our own inability, to take advantage of those things. So I think these two themes are definitely strong themes. The inability to access the big pool of European healthcare data and the inconsistency of electronic patient records based on global or European standards. And the final point is, could incentives be used to move that forward? In the US, apparently, they've used the incentive that if you don't deploy these standards and healthcare records, you don't get access to certain government funding. So maybe that's a role for incentive stroke regulation.
Thank you. I'll come to you in a second, but I'm going to come back to Peter's perhaps to pick up on that point, because one of our first speakers, Christina, mentioned the fact that some of the challenges are that the data that's being used, the research data, is based on populations outside of Europe. So this is clearly a problem because it's being picked up on again. So, Peter, what's the Commission doing about this?
Okay, there's been a lot of very good comments, which I could very much agree with, but just on this last one, I'm actually in the context of our memorandum of understanding between the EU and the US on e-health. We've actually achieved interoperability in exercises with Kaiser Permanente and some of our EHRs here, and in fact, in something that Tapani and neither Tapani nor I mentioned, the Connecting Europe facility, there is a standard for electronic health summary and e-prescription, which we're working on with the e-health network with the member states. This work is going forward. Obviously, I do have to allude back to the comment that the member states are the ones who make decisions, and often even at a lower level, a regional or city level, which provider of electronic health records they take, the way that they work. But progress is underway, and of course, there can be more of a push from this House and from other places. And then I'll just also make one comment that I think is an important one to make in response to several comments that were made on technology. Technology alone does not solve anything. I mean, there's probably ideas that are so bad that you can't implement well, but there's no idea that's so good that it can't be implemented badly. It's the procedure, it's the procedural innovation, it's the way that something is implemented that is going to make a difference. Something that I also didn't mention was the investment. For instance, in the open science cloud, in the research infrastructures, we have colleagues here from DG Research as well as DG Sante, and work that's undergoing in DG Connect on computer modeling is also linked to investments that are being made in research in biomedicine and in other areas within the Horizon 2020 program. But as Mariana Mazzucato and other economists, let's look to the right-hand side of the spectrum, Edwin Phillips, have shown, there's not a linear link between investments in research to innovation. It's also this regulatory side. It's this business side. And the colleagues were mentioning the public procurement of innovation. And it's also an opportunity to say, I think we often hear that the culture in Europe is not conducive to innovation. I would very much disagree with this if you see young people in Berlin, London, Tallinn, Riga, Warsaw, and so on. I mean, the startup scene is magnificent. We have a weakness in the big platforms, which is perhaps another issue. But this
is happening. Where we do have a cultural issue, and this is partially for good reasons, is when we look at something like public procurement of innovation in health. The incentives are often not there for the procurer to take a risk. And here I'm not thinking a safety risk. No one would ever think that we say we circumvent the medical devices certification. If it's a medical device, it has to be certified. But let's say a procedural risk. Let's do it this way. Let's do it another way. Let's do it a way that we utilize the mobile phones to try to get the gains from prevention, people smoking less, exercising more, eating better. The digital health literacy is something we take very seriously. Let's not have a digital divide, though I just saw the statistic that there evidently very soon will be more mobile phones hooked up than people with electricity, running water, or toilets in their homes. This is worldwide. So, I mean, the mobile technology is there worldwide. It's often surpassing a lot of other technology. So let's try to use it. And then I'll just finish on the way perhaps we can have more motivation for public procurement of innovation, not lowering safety levels, but having a sort of innovation principle approach where innovation is obviously not the only goal of procurement, but the only goal is also not the cheapest offer. It's one of the vital interests, innovation, good price, better result, better access for the patient. So this is a little bit of a regulatory way, while keeping safety obviously as a prerequisite. We can look to stimulate our economies and to get better access and better results for the citizens in the end.
Hello. I'm Philip Scott. My day job is a senior lecturer in information systems at the University of Portsmouth, but I'm also chair of the UK branch of an organisation called HL7, which is one of the international standards bodies for healthcare interoperability. So I'd like to pick up on what you said, because I think in many respects the standards are there, and where they are implemented, there's vast international experience of them working to various degrees, and there's very new generations of those standards. There's a thing called FHIR, F-H-I-R, Fast Healthcare Interoperability Resources, which is based on latest web technologies, RESTful for those who are into such things, which is very easily deployable, and lots of industry partners are very excited about the rapid and flexible opportunities that offers for things like patient-held applications. But I think the point about incentives to use standards is really important. And it links, I think, both to the scale issue and the big data issue. So in the UK, we have a vast chasm between family doctor, GP computing, and hospitals. GPs, over many decades, have been financially incentivized to use computerized systems. And so in primary care, there is an excellent example of computerization, because it also makes sense for the way family doctors operate as independent businesses that they have control over, and so they're naturally incentivized to work efficiently using digital technology. Whereas in hospitals, because of the way they're run in the English NHS, there is no incentive, and the professionals in the hospitals have no personal incentive to use the record. So I think there's an issue about to take that to the next stage. So it sort of worked in infrastructure terms for GP computing. It hasn't necessarily worked in data quality terms. I'm rather fearful about this big data term that's so widely used now. There's this assumption that the big data is actually meaningful data. A lot of the data is, even in GP land in Britain, where they've been doing clinical coding for years, data quality is very poor. And that's where patient access is the thing that will change things. It's when you show patients their record and they see what's wrong with it and they fix it, that's how you make the data better. And you then also have the patient engaged with their healthcare and all of those self-empowerment benefits. So to me, it's incentives around giving the patient control and ownership of the record, perhaps even taking it away from the hospital and the GP to the concept of health record banking, that you have an independent bank where the patient holds their record and they move it and they give access to whoever they want to. And then through the app, they control consent, granular consent for who they allow that access to, making it easy for them to give consent for research use of the data. So incentivize patients, we incentivize the health system to improve the data, improve the access to the data.
Also in line with what you can do with the data, I wanted to maybe comment on some of the things that have been said here about the speed of the healthcare innovations and also in relation to the regulated aspect. I think healthcare is definitely not a fast area, and developments are not happening that fast. I mean, if you look at, as you were talking about journalism, but banking, travel, business, everything is already digital, and healthcare is not yet there. But what part of healthcare is the regulated part? I think we need to now think a bit more broad because society is changing, and now we have two sectors. So there's an informal health market, which is going really fast, and there's a formal, very regulated market that is kind of steady there. And the problem is, if we don't allow to ease these transitions, we are going to have a smaller and smaller regulated part and a chaos in the unregulated part, and it's going to happen anyway, so just accept and raise a change, because this is happening, and not because of the technology push, but because of the social and the demand change. And we are not talking just about refugees and crisis elements. I mean, I'm not a refugee, but I'm a person who has lived in four different countries in the last 10 years. And I mean, where is my health record? It's just with me, because I have been taken care of it, but it's all about Europe. So I think we have to, it's not only having a more positive approach to technology, but it's all about this change. So when we talk about protecting patients and the digital divide, with all the tests we do at Philips, and maybe because our conception is always from the consumer side, and we have a lot of usability, acceptance tests, and so on, even in the telehealth business, our blocker is never the patient side. So patients, elderly people, if you really build the things according to their needs, they are full in acceptance, and not because of the control or technology element, it's because this component gives them a sense of safety. And this is a human aspect that also I would like to mention, so that before in the conversation we oppose technology to the humanity, and I don't think they are that opposed. We can bring that together. And normally the blocks in the stakeholder change of these innovation services is more on the professional side, and this has been mentioned before because of the way the incentives are run, because maybe people are not trained to this new way of working, and because of this change management. And I think that's just where we have to dig deeper, and how to restructure the healthcare processes in order to accept and embrace the change and not be so paternalistic in trying to protect the patients or the citizens who are really the ones that are demanding this change.
Hello. Can I read? Okay. Sure.
Yeah, I'm going to be a little bit long, and I also have to run in a couple of minutes. But I agree with the previous speaker. I mean, some of the comments that were made before basically start with kind of a dualism, pitching technology versus humanity, and I don't think that the world works that way. What I do feel is that we as policymakers have to make a change where we react to crisis or fears with control, and I think that's one of the aspects in policy making that we should let go, because if we indeed trust people to make and be able to make certain decisions themselves, then you create also a lot more openness in your regulation. And for example, it's one of the discussions I had with Commissioner Moidas when he was talking about this European Innovation Council to bring new products quicker to the market, is why don't you also allow the council to exempt certain new technologies, which were non-existent when regulation was made, to be exempt from certain types of regulation. It exists in some member states where you get an exemption, not on the safety issues, but on other non-essential issues, to become and be able to come much quicker to the market and have market access. That's one of the elements that I would like to bring into the discussion. Secondly, we talked a lot about regulation and regulatory frameworks. I think it's really important for us as European policymakers that you said sometimes we jump too fast, and I agree. But if we jump, let's all jump in the same direction. I often still see, also from the Parliament side, but also from the Commission side, and especially from Member State side, they go in all directions. They want to have a certain incentive here, but at the same time, they vote in legislation doing exactly the opposite, or at least making it a lot harder. So that policy coherence element, I think, especially in healthcare, is going to be crucial to guide future innovation. So I think that's something we as policymakers ourselves should be much more aware of. The last point that I would like to make is the following. The fact that, and Peter has to close his ear now because I've been saying the same thing for the last 3 days at different meetings. There is one elephant in the room when we talk about healthcare, and that's the fact that demand for health is infinite. The moment I'm sick, I want to go through 17 doctors, 3 scanners and whatever just to get the right diagnosis and a decent treatment. The supply is not. So policymakers have to make choices. And in a lot of these debates, I hear a lot of good suggestions, but it's kind of a free-for-all. And I think that we also have to make sure that we are able to prioritize and to put our money there where it is the most cost-effective, and that we allow the money also and the investment to flow in the most cost-effective manner. And the only way to do that, in my opinion, is to work on a much more evidence-based than we are doing today. And this comes back to your point. If you're not able to collect the data and analyze the data, you're not able to do that. So the evidence-based, and also the fact that science in that respect should also play a much larger role to policymakers than it does today. My Portuguese friend was mentioning this, that there are some facts out there. If you cannot even talk about the facts because you have certain political objectives, I think that's an issue. You can have an opinion about what multinational corporations are doing in the healthcare system, fine. But you cannot have a discussion about scientific facts that today it's not 100% clear that certain causality is proven. So I think, again, it's a phrase that I often use quite often, that policymakers have the right to their own opinions but not their own scientific facts. And I think that is something that should also be taken into consideration when we do policymaking. And I think all these elements together will allow us to have a much more proactive discussion about how we look at healthcare systems, a much more trustful relationship with patients and citizens than we have today, and also a much more relaxed view on how we do regulation than maybe we are doing today.
Thank you. You want to come in, then I come here. Please use the mic.
My name is Hans Osseboud. I'm from the Dutch National Institute for Healthcare Institute. One of our statutory tasks is to assess new interventions, new treatments, new technologies, and advise to the Minister of Health to uptake them, to adopt them for the national basic healthcare insurance. So e-health is at the forefront of that. In the Netherlands, the social and technological conditions for e-health digital care are actually very good, relatively. Still, the uptake and the adoption and the acceptance of digital care is really, really low. There is a big gap between, you know, the expectations and the potential and what's actually happening on the ground. Maybe you would think otherwise, but that's true. I think innovation, also in our discussion here, is quite an overrated buzzword. Innovation is not the same as improvement. And at the center of our discussion should be improvement in terms of quality of care, affordability, accessibility of care. That's a challenge for global healthcare, also in Europe, of course. I think disruptiveness contradicts with this central approach. Disruption is decentral, you know, by definition. So it comes up from, it's a bottom-up process, which cannot always be centralized from a Europe point of view. In the Netherlands, innovation, it's a local, we have local obstacles for innovation. For instance, financial obstacles, obstacles in terms of standardization, also familiarity of professionals and of patients with e-health solutions. So I think in many countries we have local obstacles which cannot be, you know, destroyed at a European level. So I would like to be maybe more precise on what regulatory frameworks you actually want to address. That would be a question of me.
Thank you.
I'm Frank Ponsaert from the cabinet of Minister of Public Health. I'm specialized in e-health and big data. For the first point, I would react on the issue on standards. I don't think standards exist because you can define a health record. And you can say, okay, in every country in Europe, we will use the same structure. But on the semantical level, on the content level, there is no standard. You can say, okay, we have SNOMED. And SNOMED, you can give it to the patient too. But that's in English. You have to translate it. Today, there is no translation in Dutch. There is no translation in French. There is no translation in German that's usable. So on the content level, we are not today at the level that we can say we have standards. So even if it's the same structure, we cannot exploit it, we cannot use it, for research, we cannot use it for communication over the border in other countries for the same patient. That's one point. And there I think Europe can help us a lot. Because when I look to the Dutch translation, there are at least two countries who need it. If I look to the French translation, I don't know how many, but it's more than two anyhow. So I think their help can be very, very useful. The other thing I would address is the fact that when we introduce we are confronted with the mobile health, with telemedicine, then we have some stakeholders as the application, the app providers. The app providers today don't see their business model. They have innovation, they have good ideas, they have a good app, very useful, but who will pay, who will make their business, how can they make their business with that app? When we look to the healthcare professional who is willing to use the app, that's disruptive in the way he works, but also in his income. So also there, the business model of the whole healthcare professional is not today usable for the context of mobile health. If we look to the public sector, to the government, also there is the apps don't have a place in it. So there we need to think how we can put mobile health in it. And finally, the patient, the business model of the patient also is completely different with the app or without the app. With an app or with the use of apps, the patient becomes the manager or the co-manager of his care. And that was not the case. That's not the case today. It was not the case in the past. Also, for those apps, is the patient, does he get it? Does he have to decide what app he will use? Or is it the professional, the care professional, who will say what app is suitable? So there is a lot of problems there. So we have four business models, and there is not any business model that is suited today for the use of mobile health. I think that's a big problem, and we can address that in every country, but I think Europe also can there play a very important role.
Thank you. Any other comments that people would like to make in response to some of the things that have been said? Chris?
I could make a long discussion of the very important points that you raised, but I'll just raise one point, and that is if we talk about the apps and the apps in mHealth, somebody has to pay. It's either the citizen as a consumer buying it, or the state providing and paying for it, or the citizen, patient, consumer is the business model and the data is being used. So we have to be clear about that. I mean, there's no free lunch, and then that's one of the issues that we do have with the data protection. Almost all the apps right now are free because there is a desire to use the data. If this is with the consent and the knowledge of the citizen, then it's fine. I mean, in a free society, but in many cases, people do not know that their data is being given or sold to data brokers, and then this is what we're trying to address with the code of conduct. But in general, in the future development, we have to look at this business model issue if we want it to flourish.
Well, you've given me an excellent bridge to the to announce that the second of this roundtable and the series of three that we're planning to do is actually on business models. So I think you've made it very clear that that's where this conversation now leads to. But let me just, you know, before we close this up today, invite anyone who would like to reflect on the nature of disruptive innovation when we think about other industries that have been through it and survived. And Peter, you were thrown a challenge that your own industry, the media industry, is going through one of these at the moment. Would we all agree that in banking and retail and other environments that have been through this, the end result has been that the systems are more efficient, they're more effective, that people are, the users are happier and more empowered? If that's the end point, then it's about generating the political will to push through some of these barriers that exist. We heard that they exist at local level, even though that's where disruption will come from. They happen even here at political level, even within the parliament. So to generate the will to move this thing forward, we need to be very clear that there will be direct benefits. Some of the messages we heard is, you know, innovation doesn't necessarily mean improvement. Sometimes it's just doing things differently for the sake of that. And I think we were talking before we came into the parliament, while we were waiting outside, and you said there's an assumption that technology, if we implement it, will just be cheaper and there will be these fantastic cost savings that will allow us to do other things. And you said, no, that's not going to happen. So we have a certain disillusionment there, given that you said the demand for healthcare is endless, the supply is limited, and a lot of people feel technology will save us. Would you like to comment on that?
Yes, I wrote a paper critiquing the current English NHS IT policy because it's predicated on saving about £8 billion based on a wish and a prayer. I mean, the EU has published studies showing that electronic health records make things better and safer, but it still costs money. There's a net cost. And that, I just think people haven't accepted the reality of that fact. Yes, it's better, but you've got to pay for it the same as you've got to pay for apps. I just wanted to come back to the healthcare as an industry and the point that was made by the colleague who's left now. I'm not sure the people that do healthcare regard it as an industry. They regard it as a vocation where they're caring for people. And I think there's something about the philosophy of how we deal with that, that it is different. It isn't banking. It isn't aircraft. So I just think there's a sensitivity that we need to take account of.
Okay. Well, on that, I would like to close our conversation. I think it was extremely valuable. I think there were some useful points put on the table. The bridge has been made to the next set of conversations around business models. And just to say that we today sees the launch of an informal working group within the European Parliament on health policies. Cross-political party, and it's across different committees. It arises from the work that Friends of Europe did on developing some recommendations on what could be done in this mandate the EU could stop, start, or do differently. We had 21 recommendations as a result of a two-year process with different stakeholders. And at our launch of the report in the Parliament, several MEPs said, well, you know, it would be interesting to see this taken forward, and often we have lots of good recommendations, but there's no follow-up. So we have launched a group of MEPs interested in taking the conversations and ideas forward, so we're delighted to say that this has now started. Thank you very much for your time and your input. I look forward to seeing many of you again at our next roundtable looking at the business models. Thank you for your time. Enjoy the rest of your day.